Saturday, April 3rd, 2021. Commerce President Barr, Representative Shawty, Parks, Anderson, Story, myself, Representative Bills, Neil, Board, and Business. This is announced today. We have to represent the county and the purchasing and project of all of the center. Thanks for being with us on this snowy Saturday, April morning. Today will be led as a new conference by Coral Davis from the Institution, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Research Week. I care for Barbara and Brad Pinkley with Alaska's first scale budgets. We're going to have a abbreviated meeting today. There's a joint committee meeting scheduled this morning starting at 1 p.m., so we'll be done a few minutes before that. Members will have a chance to ask questions as we go along. But let's let those presenters finish with the slide. And we've got a land that Colonel Gibson and Ruth Rizal and Sharon's presentation.
Members of the National Meetings Committee. For the record, my name is Carl Davis. I'm the Research Director at the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy for ITO. I would like to thank our partners for appreciating this opportunity to be able to testify before you today. On slide 10, I have a little bit of information about ITO. We're a nonprofit and citizen research group headquartered in Washington, D.C., and a number of us work out of the D.C. office and embrace the remote workforce culture, so currently out of North Carolina right now. We've been, as an organization, doing tax policy research since 1980. We do federal, state, and local research, but the state component is the biggest part of our work. On slide 3, this is a little bit of an overview of the research we've done around Lake Alaska in the last few years. 2016, 2017, which everyone knows there's and the Bank Harbor raining income tax among other tax policy changes. So during that time, we issued three reports in about the span of a year. The first looked at former Governor Bill Walker's new sustainable Alaska plan and estimated how Alaskans at different income levels would be impacted by the income tax and the excise tax changes, PFT changes. We then did a second report looking at the package of income tax and other changes that passed the House. And then we did a third report that was a little broader stroke looking at a variety of revenue options side by side. And so some of what I'm sharing today is just taken from that report. More recently, in the last year, we did a report at the request of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, zeroing in on flat rate personal income taxes in particular. So we looked at six of those and went pretty far into the weeds to show the trade-offs and not the decisions that would be made if you chose to set up the income tax in terms of what you set as the income tax base. On slide 4, I have a little bit of an overview of what I have to talk about today. We'll be discussing six fiscal actions. In order to use the FDA, change the FDA formula. Sales tax, payroll tax. Then I'll talk about two types of income taxes and a flat rate, and then I'll talk about graduated rate income taxes. I'm not going to plan to talk about smaller revenue options like a marginal tax increase. I know that's something that has received some attention, and I can't find it on that if you'd like, but it's not part of my presentation here, focusing on one of the bigger ticket items. I'm going to be talking about these margin-based sort of distribution impact across different economic classes, people at different income levels. And with that in mind, what our presentation here going to be able to deliver by really starting with what are considered the more massive revenue options, meaning that they tend to have a larger impact on lower and moderate income families relative to their household budgets. And then generally progress through to more progressive revenue options. And by progressive, I want to be clear, not talking about a particular, broad political ideology or political party. Progressive in tax, all that means is that the payment rises as a share of a household's income as income rises. So if it's a higher tax rate, then higher income folks. So if it doesn't, I'll be made clear later on. That's why I want to be clear a bit. On slide 5, a little background on how these numbers were arrived at. So the tool we use to do this analysis is called a microsimulation tax model. That's a fancy word, but the word picture is really not that complicated. You can think of it as being like turbo tax, except instead of money for your own personal return, we're running over and over and over again for a full suite of representative of tax returns that are modeled. And then when we do that, we can aggregate the results to figure out what the impact of the tax policy actually is on the state's budget. And also, different income groups, so that might depend on, families in poverty line or high income families, higher income families. So this is really the way that this kind of tax distribution analysis is always done. These kinds of models are used at the federal level in both the executive branch and the treasury, in the legislative branch at CBO and JCP, and many states use these as well. So that's the tool you see used for tax distribution analysis. So getting into the policy details on slide 6, the first thing around our report model was a hypothetical kind of PFD. And I don't think it's a big surprise here that PFD is a more important source of income for lower income families, relatively speaking, than it is for the wealthy. So in this chart, you read this left to right. On the left, you have lower income families, and the middle is middle income, and on the right is high income families. At the very high risk of the income distribution, the PFD is fairly noticeable to fraction of 1% of their income. Whereas for say single parent, poverty line, in fact, the amount of reduction in the PFD might be $1,000 per household, up around 5% less of income. So it's something I'll definitely notice when it's time for that family to pay the bills. So this is what this type of chart is sort of a textbook example of a regressive proposal to tell the rest of the left that gets you a version of the right.
I have a quick question about that chart.
Thank you, Senator Chief. When you talk about a family unit here, you're talking about a family of two, a family of three, obviously, large in the size of the family, large in the impact of the formative dividend reduction. Can you elaborate on that for me, please?
Yeah, for the chart, Representative Kennedy, so our groupings here are tax units, and so just as you said, the size of the tax unit has been varied. So it's very similar to a household, but you can have multiple tax units in one household. Basically, a tax unit is a group of people that file one single form of tax return, or in the case of a non-filer, that we expect one form of return if they get filed. So there's, there is some impact here. Actually, generally, we find the higher income groups will tend to have some of the larger tax units. So, in dollar terms, that you may see slightly larger dollar impact for a higher income family if it happens to be a larger family. The tax unit is a good portion.
Just to be clear, when you're talking about tax units, you're talking about the actual number of tax units in each of these categories that there were in FY 2019. Can you be a little bit more specific about that?
Yeah, sure. This is running 2019. Every tax unit is one observation, and then we group them into quintiles. So 20% of tax units are in the bottom quintile, 20% are in the next, and so forth, and we're up the income scale. Now we break out the top 20%, which is saying we don't have 5%, we have 7. This is we're breaking the top 20% into three groups, the next 15, the next 4, and the top 1. Now because there's an enormous amount of income in that particular group, larger variety of economic circumstances in that group, and everyone from folks earning low six-figure incomes to multimillionaires. So that's a group that everybody's is more easier to look for. But does that answer your question?
It's based on the actual tax units from that year, though, in each of these, quintiles, and then the further subdivision of that top 20.
That's right.
Different income sector, middle, north.
the broader income group is taxes generating roughly 25,000 or less than that, so it's a group that corresponds with that most effective number to be considered being in poverty. All poverty differences by a household level, so it doesn't correspond perfectly, but it's about 25,000 or so. In the middle income group, these are families as the number we have is between 60,000 and $60,000, so that was recorded in 70,000-ish. And then at the top 5% level, most big families are over $230,000 a year or so. So yeah, but this is broken out to be unique to Alaska and the Commission. The cuts between the groups have been to ensure that there's 20% of Alaska tax rates in each group. So the next slide is what is called a hypothetical sales tax. And where, again, this is an example of a regressive tax where the tax credit of the income funds as it comprises is less regressive. But the reduction in this because in real dollar terms, high income people are buying more things, and so they want to tend to pay a bit more sales tax rather than just more dollars. But lots of other income is much smaller. And the reason for that is the high savings rate at the top. The savings tax is not attached to spending. So if you're able to start to pay a big chunk of your earnings as a savings, then you're able to delay paying that tax for many, many years, maybe never paying it, depending on how it is eventually used. So this is what our hypothetical Alaska sales tax look like on the end. And the next slide, we're going to look at the more of those taxes.
I have a question on the
side
for the 3% tax that was brought in 2016, that was a cut. So that's tax rate. Remember?
To the chair, you mean like a cap for rate of purchase?
A cap on the total amount that you can pay tax on. The sales tax is one of the reasons that they're really regressive is that they cap the total amount of taxable value to like $2,500 or something like that. So somebody who buys a PIA, entry level PIA can pay the same amount in sales tax to somebody who buys a car.
To the chair, no, we did not order a cap in this instance. Alaska localities are somewhat unusual actually in both of the rest of the nation in having those kind of caps. We don't typically see that in state level sales taxes, so we did not include that in this example. But yeah, like you said, if you were to have a cap like that, I expect that you might get more progressive because of the folks that are able to make different purchases and see their sales tax payments cap. So, on slide 8, more of sales taxes here, the regressive nature of these taxes is unfortunately only in the schedule fact of them. So, these are not number 4 or 1. These are numbers taken from 4 states that have sales taxes. And you have the property to go and come out and buy the LLCs on their taxes. And so, a common tactic across all these states to block the regressive impact is to carve out the necessity for the tax. So, say, not taxing groceries or not taxing rent. And I think that does make a difference. I think it's a sensible policy to an extent. But I think that this slide shows it's important not to overpromise how much we can accomplish through sales tax exemptions. So, if most of the sales tax falls on businesses, typically at least the bottom tax also works out the tax depending on the state. And so, if the businesses pay the sales tax, then what ends up happening is that it ends up being reflected in the overall price levels in a state. So, you can try to carve out rent from sales tax base, for example, but if you're taxing lumber, you're taxing contractor services, you're going to be raising the cost of housing anyway. You know, same for groceries. You can farm out groceries, but you're taxing the utility bills of grocery stores and taxing their accountants or their advertisements. Impact yourself in the course of the thing. So, you know, I think the issue here with the effect of the sales tax on the overall price level, it has some unique implications in Alaska, where we know there's such a huge variation in prices across the state, particularly with rural areas with much higher prices. You know, it's not easy to imagine somebody living in a more isolated area that could easily pay 50% more sales tax than someone living in Anchorage, just because the prices are so much higher where they live. You know, I also think when we're selling sales tax, it's important, in my opinion, to think about the potential impact on historically marginalized communities. So in our analysis of sales taxes from other states, we found that minority groups that face discrimination and are lower average incomes because of that tend to be disproportionately impacted by sales tax. So we published a report, which has been announced in Tennessee just a couple weeks ago, showing that white families in Tennessee pay about 3.9% of their income in sales tax on average, while black and Hispanic families in Tennessee pay about 5%. And, you know, that's a 30% premium on black and Hispanic families, largely because they're more likely to fall in those lower income groups, but the effective sales tax rate tends to be higher. So, given what we know about the variation of price levels in Alaska and the geographic distribution of both populations, we don't have the data right now to do that kind of analysis in Alaska, but one thing I think maybe worth considering if you want me to make a recommendation is that if you're going to seriously explore sales tax, it might be a good idea to find someone who could do what's known as a racial impact statement. That's something that you could use to try to figure out, because the sales tax would have a sales impact on communities. Maybe the Alaska Native community, for example, where we know incomes may be lower, costs may be higher, how do those economic factors intersect in relation to sales tax? That is something that is maybe worth more studying in better understanding. So the fact that I move on to the people topic slide 9, but this is where I'm starting to transition into taxes on income. And so, the obvious question is, what is income? About 70% of it in Alaska is salaries and wages, kind of income most folks are familiar with as they get from work. And that is where payroll taxes affect, so I'll show you a slide on that in a second. There's another 30% slice of income that's other sources of money, so the PFD is in there, unemployment income will be in there, but the big sources are retirement income, so Social Security income, pension income, that's about 14% more than we'll pay in Alaska. And then the other component of income is investment income, capital gains and dividends, and then business income, business profits. So those are the yellow and gray slices here, make up a similar share. So those are the types of income and how those are affected, provided depending on what kind of income tax you are talking about. So, on slide 10, this is our distributional analysis of the payroll tax. So just taking that looks like from that last pay chart. And, what you see here, this is the tax on workers on their salaries and wages. We estimated 7 years ago, the 2.5% payroll tax could raise about $500 million in revenue per year. And you can see that we've moved beyond what are considered regressive taxes, and it's something that's a little bit messier. So it's progressive inequality income distribution, regressive inequality. And the reason for that is that pie chart I just showed you, at the lower income levels, things like Social Security income and unemployment, are more important sources proportionally for those groups. And those really are subject to a payroll tax. And so that brings down the average tax rate on lower income groups. Now, before, if you were a minimum wage worker, under a 2.5% payroll tax, you could pay 2.5%. You wouldn't be paying the 1.5% share here. But capacity for the business profits. A lot of income folks do want to sell, but it's proportionally less important to work with other minorities. It's very clear to know that higher risk data. So if you're not taxing capital gains, dividends, and business profits, then the overall tax rate on average for those high income earners will tend to be quite low because you're not taxing the sources of income there most likely not to be generating.
Yeah,
I think you said this,
just
you may have already
mentioned this, but just to be clear, in case I missed it,
when you
talk about family income,
particularly when you talk about combined personal income, yes, that is correct. Slide 11. Slide 11 is more of a current income tax. People can get a different proportional income tax. This is a flat tax levy going on to the personal income, like we're talking about, so salaries, wages, retirement, benefits. There's already the definition of income in federal statute, so adjusted gross income or AGI. So that's what most states use when they're crossing their own income tax. It's a reasonably broad definition. It's a defensible place to start for paying your state income tax. And if you modify it, obviously, but you pick up a less intensive benefit if you start with something like federal AGI. So that's what's coming here. A flat tax on federal AGI. Well, but it's a pretty flat distribution across income levels. A little bit progressive at the bottom. The reasons for that here are because the tax model would exclude the PFD. So PFD would not be taxed in this proposal. And also, embedded in federal AGI is a little bit of a tax rate on Social Security income. That also tends to be more generous as opposed to the bottom. So that creates a little bit of progressivity in the bottom here. But overall, we have flat income tax, pretty flat distribution overall. This is supposed to be a proportional tax, not really regressive, not really progressive. On slide 12, we look at another kind of flat rate income tax. There's one tax right here. But this one has a basis of zero. So the first 10,000 of earnings will be subject to this tax, or 20,000 for married couples to do that to avoid anything marriage pending. The base exemption would keep a fair number of very low income groups off the tax rolls, and it also offers a proportionately larger tax cut to lower income families. So what I mean by that, if you're a $30,000 earner and there's a $10,000 exemption, the shelter recovery of your income from tax. So that brings down your tax rate quite a bit. Whereas if you want a $100,000 earner and there's a $10,000 exemption, but you're still going to tax that, but it's only about 10% of your income. So that's why you see some progressive effect here in the distribution, even though it is a flat rate income tax, just because it's going to have this basic exemption level, which is something that most states have one way or the other, any personal exemption, student reduction. Sometimes personal credit, there's different ways to deal with that. That's slide 13, this is the last of the options. I'm sorry, I didn't consider it, the chart that was very downward sloping, that won't get one that's clearly upward sloping. This is a progressive income tax, this is actually the tax that passed the House in 2017, rates would vary from 0 to 7%. On a base that was linked to federal AGI with some additional tax rates. Not a whole lot of surprise here that the idea is high income folks would pay a higher tax rate, so they're not kind of tax that's very intentional in the design. This is the kind of tax the federal government uses, and most states have graduated rates to some degree, but they vary a lot in how graduating power. The idea behind this would be that high income families were enjoying the most economic success that society has helped make possible, can be in a position where they can afford to pay a higher tax rate. So this is really a textbook example of a progressive tax. And so the charts I have shown you are a little bit apples and oranges in some instances. They have some universities in 2016, some universities in 2019, some universities in 11 years. So what this one is doing is a little more of a standardization of those options. So what this allows you to do, we look at four policy options, and we calibrate them to raise the exact same amount of revenue. that, you can say how we're choosing one option or the other can really have a target impact on families at different income levels on average. And so the first, you're not looking for communities, but the first one is low income families that are under $25,000 group. I don't have flat taxes in the state, but for the four options I do have, you can see the PFD cut would obviously be much closer to them. Progressive income tax with an exemption will cost low-income families very little, depending on where you set that exemption level. And then sales taxes and payroll taxes fall in between those two extremes. But four out of the four options look like they are. And I have a revenue target, the PFD change would be most costly for a low-income family. On slide 15, exact same chart, but for the middle of the income distribution, so people with about a $60,000 earner or so, less pronounced differences between the options, but still notable. The PFD cut for this family would still be the largest impact. Of course, that could vary based on household size. Don't get away from the facility or PFD reduction. But the average of the middle income family, the average income family would be most affected by the PFD change. Again, the income tax, depending on the level of exemption that we look at here with the house income tax, that would be the most costly option. And then about sales and payroll taxes forming the middle. And then, for the tax side, the story changes. And this is looking at high income families, both has the top 5% in the state. You need about $230,000 in income, probably more than that now, because I think that one was a little bit. In any case, personal income tax would be the most costly for high income families. So if you have low income, you pay low income tax. Whereas, sales tax and PFD tend to just be very minimal effect on these families, and payroll tax would fall in the middle. That would depend for that family how much of their income they happen to get from their stock portfolio or from the business, as opposed to their job. Slide 17 looks at two of these options side by side, looking at a $500 million sales tax next to $500 million progressive income tax. Low income groups, much more affected by sales tax, high income groups, more affected by the income tax. And obviously there's a pivot point somewhere in here. And, our finding is that, in general, most Alaskans, depending on how you set up the income tax, but most Alaskans would likely pay less on their income tax at a given revenue target than they would on their sales tax. And there's a pretty clear intuitive reason for this. I mean, on our sales tax, the families that you are affected with the highest effective tax rate are lower income families just don't have that much money to begin with. So you can tax the poor IRAs, and it will impact their standard of living in a reasonable way. But in the big picture of the state's budget, living a high tax rate or low income families isn't going to raise an incredible amount of revenues because there's not that much money there. So in our sales tax, what that means is to hit a given revenue target, you end up having to levy a tax at a level that creates a higher tax rate on the middle class. Now, with the income tax on the other hand, if you're levying the highest tax rate at the top, families have a large amount of income, much more revenue to be raised to pay some higher income families, so that allows you to buy down tax rates in the middle. Another way to see the point of summarize is on slide 18, where I surveyed some businesses and found that about four, the income tax and sales tax that come up to that, about 4 out of 5 less than they would have paid less than they did on progressive income tax, as opposed to the sales tax. So same point, just a different model. Slide 19, very similar to the one from 2009, was talking about the PFD strategy along with the income tax, similar point. Most of it would be really impacted more by the PFD reduction than other progressive income tax. So that's the income tax distribution. One subject of the series is broader economic effects, so I might be chiming a little bit there, and I'm Mr. Keith Day is also going to be talking about this. Slide number 20, this is from a literature review of the study of state taxes and economic growth looked at 27 different academic articles. There's a huge number of studies on this topic. And, you know, the first thing to find is that it creates an opening to more studies more, creates an opening for people who are all sides of the debate to find something that might get the whole lead up at the end on state taxes and economic growth. But I think if you look at the overall literature, you'll find that what academics have found about how state taxes affect the economy, it's pretty much that. You can definitely find studies that show a higher income tax or higher taxes in general gives a chance to boost the economy. Moreover, you can also find some studies that show they can be beneficial in some instances if the money is invested in education and infrastructure and things that we know are absolutely essential to economic growth. And then I think a large portion of the academic literature finds that the mix of that to basically the balance is top. And it's hard to tease out what the impact even is. I mean, my opinion here is that the effect of state-level taxes on a state's economy is often exaggerated. I don't think there's necessarily a huge difference between a sales tax and an income tax from an economic growth perspective. I know that's just some of the research from Einstein has on this as well. If you're raising tax dollars and you're bringing up inflation, that's obviously bad for your economy. But if you're raising tax dollars and you're investing in your communities through infrastructure, education, and other quality of life improvements, then the money is still circulating in the economy. And those investors should provide more economic benefits over the long term. This is not from an academic study. This is just a little bit of a back chat from what's happened recently in states that have enacted significant tax increases. So this is looking at what happened to job creation in various states. This five states on the left here enacted a notable tax increase, and afterwards, in the decade or so after they saw job creation, they were still in line with the neighboring states. And the first states on the right don't the tax increases, and that is the slow job growth afterwards. So, again, I think this isn't the answer to this very complicated question. I think it's kind of a decent reflection on the academic literature. It's really a mixed bag. Then maybe there's some kind of effect, but it can be hard to be even to test. So, my takeaway here is that the hardest economic consequences of that discussion, if you're talking about taxes, obviously, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, this concept of that. Try to be just your program and have been very fortunate in Alaska to be able to get by without much of the way of taxes for quite a while. But in most places, taxes are, in fact, a lot. They exist for a very good reason, and if you're prudent with how you spend money, I wouldn't be overly concerned with economic impact and economic impact studies themselves. So that's all I have for my slide here. I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you today. I'd be happy to answer any more questions at the moment.
And what you're saying is that there's not clear evidence one way or the other.
Yeah, to the start, we did a study actually looking at the states that have very high, comparatively high income tax rates in the public compared to the states that don't have income taxes at all. And there's not a single difference between those states in terms of what their economy has been doing for the last decade or so. One common thing we hear about raising taxes at the top is that it's going to cause higher income people to leave to search for a lower tax rate somewhere else. There's a very high-quality study on that topic in particular. I think it's 2016. The authors had access to 13 years of confidential IRS tax return data. So they were able to follow along for 13 years a sample of high-income taxpayers that have
satisfaction with their governments and their lifestyles that might be relevant for us. And I'm just thinking in terms of the public feeling of investment in the future of their country or their state, their participation level in their democracies, those sorts of measures.
For the chair, Representative Joseph, I'm not very well versed in that literature, but I think the broad point is a very good one. We know that, there's obviously a lot of these effects, and in some ways I think that's troubling from a perspective of civic duty. I mean, the important thing with taxes is a civic duty, is a contribution to society, to the schools that my kids are going to attend, to the roads that are driving them every day. And so, this is, we should feel like more about, these investments are one of the factors that we're society together. So that's what taxes are, that's why taxes are taken in the first place. So, I think it's important to keep the investments by taxes in mind. Organization would be taking a very focused on the tax side of the ledger, having much less to offer on the budget and on the spending side. But we understand that this is what taxes is, it's incredibly important.
Thank you very much for your presentation today. Next up, we're going to go to Brad Keaton, the Alaska Interest Sustainable.
issue that I've worked on for the last decade through the Alaskans for Sustainable Budget Project, and I look forward to sharing my thoughts with you today. Slide two, please. We're going to focus my time today on three issues. What are the measures of economic impact? I think that's an important criteria to understand when we're talking about economic impact out of a measure. Three studies that, in my experience, have really delved into the issue. The 2016 ISIL study, which is sort of the gold standard for this issue. The 2019 Buckeye Institute study and the 2020 Tax Foundation study. And I'm going to talk a little bit about balancing the impacts. I will say that that my presentation does not address the economic impact of changes in law and corporate taxes. That's an entirely different subject. Slide three, please. Before starting, I want to put this discussion in that broader context. What I'm talking about here are the economic impact of various actions available to close the persistent budget deficits that lie ahead for Alaska. This is my version of the 10-year forecast. And it shows using current oil futures prices a continued deficit over the next decade that will average out to about $700 million. That assumes that the oil prices stay at the levels that are included in the futures market now. What we're talking about are the options for closing that deficit going forward. And in a very real sense, we're talking about competing alternatives for closing that deficit, each with its own set, with each alternative with its own set of economic impacts. What we should be striving for is to identify the alternative, set of alternatives, that has the lowest, least adverse impact on the overall Alaska economy and Alaskan families. As I said in 2016, today, however, we've been using the option that has the largest adverse impact on the overall economy and Alaska families. And I welcome this opportunity to talk about what I think are the lower impact alternatives. Slide four, please. So in measuring the economic impact, the ISIR study, again, as I say, even now, 5 years later, this remains the most comprehensive look at both the options and their impacts. The ISIR study looked at four impacts on 10 options. Four impacts were the impact on overall Alaska income, impact on overall Alaska jobs, the distributional impact by income level, which is what Carol talked about, and the regional impact, the different impacts of the various options on the regions of upstate. Buckeye and Tax Foundation studies are relevant, but they're much more limited in the scope of what they talk about. Slide five, please. So after looking at 10 options for dealing with closing the deficit, four of them were spending cuts, one on reducing the number of state workers, one on reducing the capital spend, the state's capital spend, third, a broad-based approach, which was a combination of reducing workers and reducing capital spend. And then the fourth was pay, reducing salaries of state workers. Not necessarily reducing state workers, but reducing the salary of state workers. From the standpoint of revenues, they looked at six options. Progressive income tax, what they call the flat rate income tax, but isn't the same type of flat rate income tax that the Carol was talking about in this presentation, or is it HB 37, Representative Bull's bill, it's referred to as flat rate tax in some of the other studies. Let's talk more about these differences in flat rate taxes in a bit, but I want to highlight the answers. There isn't one size fits all flat rate for the tax. And then the third, they looked at dividend cuts. They looked at two types of sales taxes, one with more exemptions, one with fewer exemptions. And then they looked at a property tax. So this is the output from the ISIR study summarizing the impacts of the various options on Alaska income and jobs. And what this study does is they look at a low scenario for each approach, a high scenario for each approach, the impact of that scenario on low and high impact on income, at least at this point, it's fairly simple to see the relative size of the impact. So, for example, the dividend cut has the highest impact on income, certainly of all available revenue options. It's 9.7% higher than any other, the adverse impact is 7% higher than any other revenue option. In the case of the PFD, it's also using PFD cuts to fund that gap, the fundraising gap, has a higher adverse impact on income than even any of the spending cuts. When you go over the employment impact side, certainly the spending cuts tend to have a higher impact on jobs, but also on the employment side, the PFD has the largest adverse impact on any of the revenue options for filling the fiscal gap. The PFD is 9% higher than the next highest revenue option.
Study I'll talk about just briefly. The first study of the town, first Alaska families. That was done in 2017. And then the second follow-up study was for the Binnahans and Harvard in Alaska. Next slide, please. Taking together, take the base 2016 study and then the two follow-up studies, these are the, I think, the notable findings relevant to the economic, relevant to the issue we're discussing today, taken from the ICU studies. The impact of the 2016 report, the impact of the TFD cut falls almost exclusively on residents and is highly regressive, so it has the largest adverse impact on the economy per dollar of revenue raised. Now, that's comparing it to the other revenue options and concluding that it has the largest impact and adverse impact on the economy of any of the revenue options. I want to focus on one piece of the TFD cut that I think is important, because it helps drive this issue, drive this conclusion. And that is, TFD cuts are the only tax approach, the only revenue approach that takes all the money from Alaskans. If you look at a sales tax or an income tax, more residents are contributing, either through income earned in Alaska by non-residents, or sales to non-residents that collect on the tax. That contribution from non-residents could be can vary from 7% to 15%, depending upon the option you're looking at. TFD cuts, and so when you have $100 million you're trying to raise, for example, 7% to 10% to 15% of that is coming from non-residents. When you look at TFD cuts, 100%, 99% is actually attributed some TFD income to people who qualify for the income that they live in the state. 99% of that is coming from Alaska residents. So you can understand quickly that it has had a larger adverse impact on Alaskans in substantial form, because you're only taking money from Alaskans. You're having to contribute all of the 100 million, as opposed to only having to contribute 90 million out of the 100 million. And that's a big impact of using TFD. The second conclusion from ICER paper in 2017, first family study, a cut in TFDs made by private purchases made for Alaska families. Trying to reduce the mutual effect, sales taxes would be the next process for households with children. And then an interesting conclusion, the effects of any of the fiscal options on incomes, of households without children would be much the same. So income for households that don't have children, which tend to be upper income households, would be largely affected to some degree the same by a sales tax or by an income tax or by any other approach. Next page, page 12, please. The regressive nature. The 2016 study that focused on PFDs and poverty in Alaska concluded that the PFD annually lists 15 to 25,000 Alaskans out of poverty, depending upon the size of the dividend, and reduces the number of Alaskan businesses living in poverty by 1/4. Reducing the PFD by 1,000 will likely increase the number of Alaskans below the poverty line by 12 to 15,000. So when you think about state spending, if you think about the portion of state spending that is going to support the lowest income levels, we're actually increasing the number of people that fall into that category by using TFD cuts as the way to raise revenues. We're actually increasing their costs on the cost side as well by using TFD cuts to raise revenue. We use something less regressive that didn't fall as far on the lower income bracket. We would have lower pressure, reduced pressure on state spending for that. The triple net rack as well. Next slide, slide 13. The Buckeye Institute report looked at the issue. It's important to note that the Buckeye study didn't look either at the distributional or regional analysis. So they didn't do any sort of analysis about the impact of the various revenue options they looked at on Alaska families by income category. They just looked at sort of the gross Alaska income level. And they didn't look at it because they didn't do a distributional study. I also didn't look at it regionally, so there's no analysis in the Buckeye study of what the impact is on minority regions. We used a national argument for reducing state government spending, national argument in the sense that there was a narrative, there wasn't any analysis done. They said it would be helpful to reduce government spending, it's important to reduce government spending, but there wasn't any impact like you will find in the actual study. There wasn't any impact of what that reduced government spending would do on the overall economy, on income, or on jobs. It was just a narrative argument, if you will. The analysis that they did there on the revenue alternatives, they did in two separate pieces that were it's interesting. They did a static model, which is what the Bessel model is, just measuring sort of the first order impact of the revenue approach. But then Buckeye also did using a model that they disclosed and they discussed in the paper. They also did what they called a dynamic model. And a dynamic model measures the second and third order impacts of a revenue approach, predicts how the individual households and businesses will alter their economic choices in response to the revenue approach. So if you have a sales tax, for example, while people reduce their purchases and as a consequence reduce the level of revenue that you thought you were going to get out of the sales tax just based on looking at historic sales, will they reduce their purchases and ultimately reduce the tax. The dynamic aspect of the Buckeye report is looking at that. Slide 14. Well, this is what Buckeye came up with when they looked at it. The number on the left is what the options they looked at for sales tax, the flat tax, which actually is a payroll tax when you look at the tax codes they're using, progressive income tax, and then a proportional tax of state income tax, which is, frankly, $100 in income tax, I'm going to pay 5% of the income tax. That sort of tax base, the tax base, is extremely progressive because they're only taxing on the people who pay federal income tax. A lot of Alaskans, huge number of Alaskans pay payroll taxes, but only about the top 40% pay income taxes. If they're only taxing the top 40% when you're talking about the fourth category. They modeled what the revenues were going to be on a static basis, that is, the first order effects, and then they ran through the dynamic model of the second order effects. Were very normalized these, just like the ISO study does, kind of normalized these to put $100 million of dynamic revenue raised to sort of be able to compare these apples to apples. You don't quite get that out of the Buckeye Institute report because they didn't normalize to a standard level of revenue. So I've done that to compare apples to apples. And what you see is it's something really interesting. And again, some of this is driven by the dynamic model. Well, a lot of it is driven by the dynamic model. So, for example, sales taxes have a large adverse impact, have a large impact sales taxes have a low impact. Sales taxes have a low impact on GDP, gross domestic product, and gross state product. And they have a low impact on investment. That is, if you have an income tax, you're going to have more adverse impact, more cost to investment, according to the dynamic model, and under sales tax. But look at these numbers on jobs. Employment, what their dynamic model is saying is that sales tax has a larger adverse impact, probably over trades, a larger adverse impact on jobs than any of the other revenue options than any of the payroll taxes. And sales taxes certainly have a larger adverse impact on consumption, the amount of economic activity, economic trade going on in the state, certainly have a larger impact on consumption. So there's no clear, there's even in the Buckeye report, there's no clear winner once they run this stuff through the dynamic model. Sales taxes have a larger adverse impact on jobs, have a larger adverse impact on consumption. Payroll, sales taxes have an advantage over income taxes. terms of GDP or in terms of investment?
Next slide, please.
Question from Representative Pence from San Bernardino. Given this result, a larger negative impact on jobs, sales taxes, a larger negative impact on jobs, a lower negative impact on gross domestic product. That seems quite right to me.
Well, gross domestic products is made up of a lot of things. I mean, a lot of our gross domestic product is driven by auto. So that's sort of setting aside a little bit. But gross domestic product is affected by business investment or by manufacturing or by investment generally. So you can see that sales taxes have a lower impact on investment. So by using a sales tax as opposed to an income tax, you're increasing the amount of investment. That helps drive a positive impact relative to the positive impact on GDP.
Okay, and thank you for the second. Do you have a follow-up question, Mr. President? Okay, Representative.
Oops.
Yeah, I've never trawled through the appendix that talks about the dynamic model to be able to answer that. The appendix goes on for several pages, but I've never done the numbers on how many iterations are going through.
Mr. Davis, do you have any comments on the issue that dynamic modeling that was used in the 2019 Beckett Institute report or the analysis on its different marketing measures in terms of GDP?
So, Chair, I agree with Representative Pence that it's a surprising result to see GDP and jobs moving in such different ways. It seems to me I haven't given the study very quickly. It does seem to me that this is probably done more to take into account the effect of government spending in advanced significance. And so then that one, I think, is a big part of the picture of the state level dynamic score, because the money is on one side and then the dynamic model that will kind of show negative economic impacts. Well, the money is spent on the spending side, which is a positive economic impact. So it's a little bit unclear how that's taken into account. I mean, I would say we do not run the dynamic model at ITAP. My opinion is that these are much more speculative analyses. There are a huge number of assumptions that go into building a dynamic model in terms of how our high income taxpayers can respond and how our visitors can respond. And the number of economic relationships and just linked together to run a dynamic model like this is incredibly complex. And they do have a little bit of a reputation for being gameable, meaning that you can use them to produce a huge range of results. The modeler has a lot of control here in a way that's not true to the same extent of, say, facts where you're stuck looking at. What the IRS is reporting, how much income is there, who's bracketed, how many deductions are there. There's economic models, there's a lot more assumption based in that here. So I tend to come up with a somewhat skeptical view in general.
Thank you.
Next slide, please.
Thank
So the final study. Is the 2020 Tax Foundation study. It's a good read, but there's not distributional regional analysis like the Buckeye study. They don't tell you what the impact is of their various alternatives by family or by income group or by region. I think that's a big problem. sales, income, motor fuel, and oil and gas taxes for the family's in terms of revenues. Next slide. The notable argument for the tax foundation is that because, and again, it's a theory argument, it's not, they don't analyze numbers. It was done by the nicer guys to look at what the detailed impacts are. The argument is because it's imposed on consumption, rather than labor, the economic impact of the sales tax is smaller, and collections are less volatile than under income tax. They do, I will say that the tax foundation study is very useful in terms of talking about the breadth of the sales tax. Sales tax is covered in all sizes and flavors. Some have exemptions, some don't. Some have tax, some don't. The tax foundation makes a very strong argument that if we would move to a sales tax, then it should be a sales tax that would apply broadly to both goods and services. The services are usually not included well in sales taxes, but it would be a broad-based tax that would include both goods and services. And by doing it that way, you reduce the distributional effects of the tax, you don't eliminate. Because you're still excluding the amount of income that goes to savings and to investment from the scope of the tax, and you can include services, you're excluding that, and that tends to be identified that savings and investment largely proportionately larger at the higher income level. So you don't eliminate the distributional effects, but the scope of the sales tax is something that they focus on as being important. And then they talk a little bit about motor fuel tax, that the remedy is the motor fuel tax would be insufficient, but it could be as part of an overall tax scheme that makes sense, particularly since it's affects only state or rural economy would be less. Next slide. I'm going to talk a little bit about flat taxes and flat taxes are the same. It's important when you talk about any tax that immediately ask what the base is. Because the base controls how broad the tax is going to be, it's going to control what your percentage is going to have to be raised or not to do. It's going to control the distributional impacts. As I said before, if you just do what your tax on the federal income taxes paid, just as a surcharge on federal income taxes, then you built in a huge progressivity from the outset. So when you're talking about flat taxes, you need to ask rate tax. You need to ask immediately behind it, what's the tax base? ICER used taxes on income as the tax base for background tax. You can see it has a smaller base, takes a higher percentage to higher flat tax percentage to generate the same amount of revenue. But I think all the flat tax is essentially payroll tax, which is something between taxable income and taxes paid. Tax foundation used adjusted gross income. When we talked about flat tax, we used adjusted gross income. And what Carl talked about, the ICAP December 2020 study, uses adjusted gross income with exemptions, two levels of exemptions. So, again, when you're talking, you get to say, I support a flat tax. You have to sort of get what the base is in order to understand. Next slide. So, the way forward, what's the way forward on all this? Balancing the impacts. Determining the overall economic impact of each option requires balancing various criteria. Their income impact, impact on jobs, impact on investment, the distributional impact, and the regional impact. You can't just say, when you're talking about economics, you're talking about all of these impacts. You're not just talking about one of the impacts. And the best solution would be one that evaluates the overall of the categories and sort of come to the conclusion that it's the best. There is no form best. For example, some criteria sales tax has the lowest impact on GDP, for example, or the lowest impact on investment, but it's unavoidably regressive and has a disproportionately higher adverse impact on people of lower income class families and regions than other alternatives. And so it's best in some categories and not best in other categories. Next slide.
supports that work. And the ICE study, which again was the most comprehensive look at this, again, we're focused on the competing alternatives to close our fiscal gap. What are we going to use to close the continuing fiscal gap across the next decade? And we have details to close that fiscal gap and the largest adverse impact on both the overall national economy, as measured by ISO, the income impacts, the jobs impact, the largest adverse impact on the overall national economy and Alaska families of any of the revenue options. It also has, as Carl talked about, a huge disproportionate impact, adverse impact on the distributional analysis and on the regional analysis. When I talked about this issue, I've supported the flat tax based on AGI, even if you include the bids, based on adjusted growth income, because it has a relatively low impact on all the factors, on jobs, on income, on investment, on GDP, relatively low across the board. It's distributionally and regionally neutral. You're not charging lower-income Alaska families more than higher-income Alaska families. They all have the same skin in the game. So you're not distorting the regional impacts. You're hitting low-income regions more than higher-income regions. And importantly, from my perspective, also ensures that all Alaska families have the same spend in government spending. They're all affected by increases or by decreases through the tax cuts, by increases or decreases. And I don't spend it. Look at something like PRP cuts. PRP cuts have a huge impact on middle and lower income Alaska families, a negligible impact on the top 20%. If in the reverse, you look at the percentage of federal income taxes paid, that has a huge impact on the top 20%, something of an impact on the next 20% down, but zero impact on lower middle and on low income Alaska families. So, you can get a distortion in who's lobbying for what as a result of changes to the differences in the impact. The flat tax has all the last of the families having the same outstanding government spending.
All right.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be here today to join Carl talking about the impact of the current solutions on the Alaska economy. As I said, it's something I've worked on in the last decade through the Alaskans for Sustainable Budget Projects. And I appreciate the project and the opportunity to have the opportunity to share my thoughts with you today.
All right, thank you very much, Representative Hardy.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the presentation, Mr. Casey. I really appreciate it. I know Tim will agree with the proposal generally that at the very least we need to have a solution that spreads out the burden and that we don't grow it. Disproportionately lowering families in the regions. You know, I think one thing that applied on all of this is there's no other alternative because that we do nothing to address revenue, and that too addresses or disproportionately affects lower income families in regions that really depend on state services. So I don't want to have a say on it, but would you agree with that conclusion that if comparisons are often going to drive the economy as bad as it's just simply
well, there's two other options. One is, I mean, that's the spending kind of option that you're talking about. And I forbid you to study on what impact that has on income and on jobs. And certainly, depending upon what services you cut or cut, if you cut services that are going to low-income families, certainly not going to have an adverse impact, disproportionate adverse impact on low-income families. The other thing I would say is that the other alternative that someone talked about is just overdrawing the ERA and using that to fund the gap. That's just a tax on future generations. I mean, you've got presentations about how that lowers the investment base and lowers the future income. So, but there's no free lunch. What you're looking for is what spreads the burden the most broad, the most stark, the most equitably, and has the lowest adverse impact on the overall economy.
One last question for you over time. But yeah, I was just curious, do you have any information on just the cost of a price comparison between a flat tax or progressive tax is more than zero and cost to administer than the other?
It depends on your price. If you use federal adjusted gross income or both back on the federal income tax form. If you try to craft the rule of verbal for the 2015 progressive income tax and government work rules, is it wasn't piggybacking on HGI or TI or anything. It was creating its own Alaska tax with our own our own income, our own definition of income, our own definition of expenses. And that was going to be administratively much more costly because we were going to have to create our own form. So it really depends on the base you're using. The administrative difficulty depends on the base.
So we're going to have a lot more time to discuss these items. I really want to encourage everybody to read the ITAP study that Mr. Davis referenced on this second slide. They are Alaska-specific analysis. They are very interesting. We are also going to hear from ICER at a future hearing about the analysis. ICER's done several analyses, and we're going to hear from them. That gives an opportunity to talk about them a little bit further. The next thing we have for the Ways and will be this Tuesday, April 13th at 11:30 a.m. here at the HR 106. And we're going to hear first bills on your HB 165, an appropriation from the Range Reserve to the Permanent Fund and HJR 1, and Permanent Fund, the earnings of your bills from the representative Don and Price Pound and Joanna. So I think you're after a hearing on each of these. And that takes me by interest and move on to the future today for final decision. So no further business before the committee today. We're going to adjourn at 12:52 p.m. Thank you.